Just a quick tour of the front pages before I bring in my first guest. The front page of the Sunday Times, that story you heard from Ben in the news a couple of moments ago. Donoghue to cut €350 COVID-19 payout in June. The government will begin to reduce the level of the pandemic unemployment payment next month to thousands of workers who were earning less than €350 a week before COVID-19 struck, after ministers and industry leaders warned that it was stopping some staff from returning to work. Pascal Donoghue and Regina Doherty will bring proposals to Cabinet next Friday following discussions with Leo Varadkar and Heather Humphreys to pay part-time workers the equivalent of their average earnings before the pandemic to remove any disincentive from returning to the workplace. The government will also renew discussions on whether to make self-isolation mandatory for international travellers to Ireland after ministers raised concern about its impact on food supply chains, business and the movement of airline and medical personnel. Also, quite a lot, as you might imagine, in the Sunday Times about Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson's refusal to throw him to the wolves, as it were. Front page of the Business Post, nursing homes told to withhold information on COVID-19 outbreaks. Susan Mitchell tells us that nursing homes were told not to tell residents and families of the extent of COVID-19 outbreaks in their by their representative group. In March, Nursing Homes Ireland, which represents the private and voluntary nursing homes, circulated a memo to its members. The memo has been seen by the newspaper. It stated that the nursing home has been instructed by the National Public Health Emergency Team not to provide such updates relating to the total number of suspected or confirmed cases identified in the home. In a statement, NFET denied giving any such instruction. It said it had not issued advice in relation to nursing homes communicating with families in that regard. Front page of the Sunday Independent. Very big interview with Mary Lou McDonald, possibly the first time ever that a Sinn Féin leader has sat down for such an extensive interview with the Sunday Independent. Mary Lou, Sinn Féin, the IRA and me, every chance she would have taken up arms in a justified campaign by the IRA, and she attacks the plagiarism and theft of Sinn Féin's policies now by Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. Very large spread inside the paper on that. And finally, for now, the front page of the Mail on Sunday, Cabinet in turmoil. Government is afraid to reject civil service advice, concerns over tough public health measures being ignored, and ministers fearing that Ireland is turning into a police state. John Lee has this story. Several members have spoken of cracks in cabinet unity, growing enmity between politicians and senior civil servants over COVID-19 and their personal pressures during lockdown in a series of briefings to the Irish Mail on Sunday. In incendiary language, one minister spoke of his concern that Ireland is turning into a police state, and there's fear in government that too much power has been ceded to senior civil servants in the formulation of emergency restrictions. Cabinet ministers told the Mail on Sunday they fear making decisions that could overrule the advice of their officials because of the possible effect on their political careers and reputations. And as a quick look at this morning's front pages, we will talk about them in more detail with Kevin Doyle and Sinead O'Carroll a little later. But let me first of all bring in my first guest this morning, Professor Sam McConkie, who is the head of the Department of International Health and Tropical Medicine at the Royal College of Surgeons. Sam, good morning to you.
Good morning, Gavin.
And thank you very much for taking our call this morning. Can I just first of all pick your brain on something which appears to have come really much out of the blue in the last 36 hours or so? That is a debate in Cabinet around whether the social distancing guidelines, which currently require people to remain 2 metres apart, should be relaxed to be 1 metre apart. And that is because the World Health Organization says 1 metre is sufficient. Is 1 metre sufficient, or why would there be different advice between what NFET and the European authorities are saying and what WHO says?
So the ways to control the transmission of COVID-19 have been different in different countries. And in Ireland, we've largely followed the European Centre for Disease Control, which is in Stockholm, which is a pan-European scientific advisory group. And my view is that following their advice has been very wise and very sensible. They're an advisory group mainly for the EU, not a worldwide body. The WHO, as you know, has a worldwide remit. So I think this debate is a really good one to be having. The issue of, as we are now gradually controlling the spread of COVID-19 in Ireland much better than we were 4 or 6 weeks ago, the reproductive rate has decreased dramatically and we're seeing fewer cases each day. We now have to have a big public debate about which restrictions we start to relax first. And I'll just provocatively put up 3 or 4 different options. For example, could we get our creches back up and running, get our schools back up and running as one choice of our main next step for relaxing restrictions? Or number two, could we encourage tourists to start coming from all over the world to Dublin Airport and to explore our country and migrate or travel around our country as tourists? Or three, the one that you're proposing, which is, let's call it physical intimacy, where we're getting from 2 metres to 1 metre. I know 1 metre doesn't sound very intimate,
no,
but that's a real... it's a relaxation of restrictions in a different way. And my point is that you shouldn't do all three together. We should do these gradually and in a stepwise way. And we have to make really important informed political choices about which parts of our society we should try and get back to normal first. And certainly getting physically closer to each other certainly would allow restaurants and bars and so on to function better, and we'd all probably have a better time. That would inevitably lead to more transmission of COVID-19. And unfortunately, people think that 2 metres to 1 metre, that's just half as much. Therefore, you might just expect things to be perhaps twice as bad because you're half the distance away. But the way droplets and things work, often it's not just a simple linear relationship. When you're at 1 metre rather than two, it could be up to four times more transmission that takes place when you're closer, because there's a much bigger concentration of droplets. It's often a square function or a cubic function, even in some cases, that controls these mathematical relationships. So the R number, this reproductive rate, is influenced by how close we are to other people. It's the number of people we meet, how close we are to them, and then our chances of being infected. So the R number is influenced by social proximity. That's why it's been this 2 metres up to date. And that is one political choice, Gavin, that we could make as a nation and say, yes, we're going to get 1 metre from each other. But then that would possibly mean that things like getting schools back or getting the airports open and tourists coming again might wait longer. And you can imagine how different sectors of our economy have vested interests in different of those choices that I've just outlined. The parents obviously want, and the children of course would want to be back to school and creche. The tourist industry and the airlines would want the travellers to be coming into Ireland and travelling around, and of course the restaurants and bars want us all to be at 1 metre. So, and this is really a political decision to balance the public health risks and the potential increase in transmission from any of those three against the social and economic and community benefit. So this is where I would say we do need politicians. We have 160 elected representatives in Dáil Éireann now for the last couple of months, and we need them to be really hammering out debate, challenge, proposals, and with the benefits and disadvantages of almost each of those three. And I'm not, there may be four or five other things that I haven't even considered that are meritable as first steps on relaxing our restrictions. So we're certainly now should be talking about relaxing restrictions, and we should be comparing it one against another and asking which one first.
So is that to say then that the World Health Organization, when it has only recommended a minimum of 1 metre up till now, that it is basically factoring in the prospect that by only keeping it at 1 metre instead of 1.5 or 2, that you are inherently allowing people to transmit the virus much more frequently than they would otherwise?
Yeah, exactly. So they are accepting that there will be some transmission of virus. And as long as we keep the transmission rate, as you know, as long as each case produces less than one additional case, then our pandemic will gradually continue to fizzle out. But if that famous R number goes over one and we're seeing a rise in cases each day, then our epidemic is becoming out of control, and then we end up risking another horrible sort of catastrophe. So it's a matter of keeping the amount of transmission less than one new case for each old case, and that's a really important priority. So we can't, you can't do all of the relaxation suddenly. That's why I've so strongly objected to this idea of lockdown, because it suggests it's simply a switch. You lock down and then you open your lock and everyone's free. That isn't the model that works mentally here. We've got to gradually and in small steps incrementally relax the restrictions, and we should have a big public debate about which ones to relax first. And certainly 1 metre rather than two is one very reasonable thing to be part of that debate, but it's up against getting our creches going, getting our schools going, getting our kids back to school in June. It's up against people travelling in from other countries who might have COVID-19 and reinfect us again. So there's lots of different considerations, and alternative groups in our society, quite rightly, are lobbying for what suits their own industry and their own personal values. And that's the role of politics and governance, is to bring those competing interests together into one national policy and then lead it forward and implement it.
But just to be clear on how best to inform that debate, you're saying with your expert hat on that if you were to consider reducing the 2 metre threshold to 1 metre, inherently you are making the virus maybe four times more transmissible than it otherwise would be.
Exactly. And if our R number is very low, then at some stage, I really hope, Gavin, we'll all be back within 1 metre of each other at some stage in the future. That's, of course, what we'd all love to be. And so, but it is making the virus more transmissible, yes, because the distance between people in influences quite strongly the risk of coughing and sneezing and droplets going on another person. And it's not that 2 metres is a magic number, it's just that the more distance, the less transmission. And 1 metre, definitely, I'm sure you've obviously seen yourself when people sneeze. I know we all rather disgustingly sneeze occasionally, and all the little droplets come spewing out if the sun is shining on your sneeze, and you can see them easily go a metre. So it's not even disputed that droplets can go a metre. This is unquestionably the case. Now, of course, we should avoid meeting sneezing people. We should try to keep our distance from other people who are sneezing. And if we are sneezing, maybe we should be wearing a face covering so that if I sneeze and I'm even within 2 metres of you, that my sneeze mostly is trapped in the face covering. That's why face coverings out in public places and public transport and bars and restaurants and shops is perhaps a very sensible way forward, because it prevents that sneezing droplets all going out into the public. But yes, shortening the distance increases the risk of transmission, absolutely, definitely.
Okay, and if it's up to politicians then just to decide that that is a risk that they're willing to countenance, then at least on their heads be it, but at least they can make that decision. On the topic of face coverings, just by the way, before I let you go, we're now 1 week in to the 12-week process. We were advised that if we were going into public areas, particularly the likes of supermarkets, that face coverings would now be recommended, albeit not mandatory. 1 week in, it seems to be that there's very little take-up of that. Are you surprised at that, or do you think that the government should perhaps go that step more to make it mandatory in public areas?
I think we're probably, as a country, not very widely comfortable with being mandatory things like face masks. It isn't a very culturally acceptable thing. Now, of course, you can say a lot of what we've been through in the last 2 months hasn't been culturally acceptable either. The idea of not being able to walk more than 2 kilometres is very odd for most of us. But my view is that a recommendation is the way to go. Many people, it maybe varies from place to place, but around where I am, I'm seeing lots of people wearing face masks out, particularly not so much outside. The outside is less important, Gavin. It's more the indoors in shops, in the buses and the trains, in the public transport, and when you're close or potentially close by to somebody else. So I wouldn't advocate mandatory. I think that risks provoking a sort of a backlash of people who just feel that this is infringement on the way they dress and whatever. So I think that might not be an acceptable measure that's going to be improve things. I think it might make things worse.
Okay, Professor Sam McConkie, Head of the Department of International Health and Tropical Medicine at the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland. Thanks very much for joining us this morning on The Record. Really, really appreciate your time, and certainly very helpful to know exactly what the difference is between advocating 1 metre and 2 metres of social distancing. Let me go to my newspaper panel briefly for some thoughts on that. We'll be joined by Sinead O'Carroll of thejournal.ie in a moment. But first, Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at INM. Kevin, it strikes me that if ministers were so keen, and obviously there was understandable anxiety about trying to get back to 1 metre because of the business help that it would be, but it's a fairly sobering reminder of just exactly what the stakes are if you're being told that the virus could re-emerge 4 times more quickly by doing so.
Yeah, and listening to Sam there, it's a real chicken and egg scenario, because the 3 hypotheticals that he set out for you, Gavin, be it do you open creches and schools first, do you let tourists in, or do you do this physical intimacy approach, the problem is that creches and schools will be an awful lot easier to open if you bring down the social distancing, the physical distancing, from 2 metres to 1 metre. So in theory, you would suggest that that would be the thing you would do first, is to go for this shorter distance. At the same time, and this is reflected in the papers a lot this morning, there are parents all over the country desperate for creches and schools to reopen. And if they were told it meant you had to stay 2 metres apart for a bit longer, but that the creche would get open in June or July, they would jump on that option, I think, first. So there is no easy answer to it. I think that's the one thing that came out of Sam's analysis there, because everybody has skin in this game and everybody wants a different outcome to be the top priority.
I suppose, Sinead O'Carroll from thejournal.ie, good morning to you. I guess it really does highlight the whole question mark about whether you stay the course for a couple of weeks longer. I mean, I know there are even some in public health, like Anthony Staines, who is advocating against just trying to almost stay in phase zero of lockdown for a little longer and extinguish the virus completely. That it's a trade-off between, do you start moving things back now? And if so, then do you just accept a natural risk that the virus is going to just get out there again?
Yeah, and there's no obvious path, I think, of that. Like, even if the decision makers were saying, right, we'll just take a populist approach, it's really hard to figure out what the populist approach is. Is it to, you know, make face coverings mandatory to lock everyone down a bit more? Or is it to follow what a lot of columnists are saying today, is open the economy up, make sure that we're not complete laggards in Europe when it comes to when we are all opening up and being more worried about our paychecks and our economy than we are about virus transmission? And it's really hard to tell which side is more popular right now. And is it as divisive as maybe it seems when you do sit down on a Sunday morning and read all the great minds writing in the papers? So it is. And then when you're looking at it, the next thing we'll be talking about is government formation. So the people making these decisions are making it in very precarious positions of their own.
I suppose the question, though, and part of the reason why people might be looking at whether we can relax from 2 meters to one, Kevin, is because there's been, you know, we talk about being laggards. You know, Sinead makes a fairly good point. We do now appear to be among the slowest countries in the world to emerge from our lockdown. In fact, I saw one analysis during the week which reckons that actually, as it stands right now, we have a more prohibitive lockdown than anyone else.
Yeah, and there is evidence to back that up. Dan O'Brien is actually making the point in the Sunday Independent today that according to an Oxford University study, we have the strictest lockdown at this stage among comparable countries in terms of income and economy, and that the mobile data that Apple and others have been compiling shows that Irish people's mobility has fallen further than almost any other country in the world, with the exceptions of Italy and Spain, who obviously had a far worse situation for a long time in this. And so, yeah, how far is too far is the question. But it seems now, if you look at the press conferences that Tony Holohan gives every evening and the data that's been coming out, that community transition is almost completely wiped out. And the problem now, as we start to open up again, is that obviously community transmission will start again and the numbers will go up. And I think the worst thing that could happen is that you end up in a scenario where we open up, we get back to whatever the new normal is, and then we have to close down again. And I think for people's mental health, apart from the economy, that will be absolutely devastating, to think that we saw the light at the end of the tunnel and that there was some sort of avalanche or something happened that meant that we were pushed back completely. I think that would be very, very difficult for people to deal with, not just individuals, but also businesses, to actually go through that twice, you know?
Sinead, do you agree with that idea of going softly, softly, and rather having a prudent or slower roadmap which you can stick to, rather than the idea of potentially giving people a glimpse of freedom and then having to rein it back in again?
It is one of the hard things, Gav, preparing for panels like yours this morning, is that there are so many unknowns. Usually you come armed with some interesting facts that you read in reports that week, or, you know, you found something different than what's in the papers. But at the moment, it's really difficult to do that, because even with Dan O'Brien's piece, where you're reading through it and he's making, you know, backed up points, he has reports, there is this big unknown. If he's talking about, you know, the virus, but and how it reacts in 15 to 45 year olds. We've seen that there haven't been too many deaths in that cohort of people. The argument is those could go back to work. But if they do start getting sick, they still might end up in hospital. They still might bring COVID into hospitals. Then you're seeing more COVID in ICUs. And there's still that big unknown of, okay, well, even if that cohort don't die, they might transmit the virus in a way that could still bring devastation to the country. So is that worth that risk? And we just don't know yet.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the latest figures from the HPSC as of yesterday, and they're confirming that even among under 15s, there are still over 400 cases. So we shouldn't just fall into the trap and think that younger people are completely immune to this, and irrespective of whether they have underlying conditions or not, it's not as if that they are completely immune or non-susceptible to this. Guys, I want to pick your brain on the front page of the Sunday Times, if I can. Pascal Donoghue, apparently to announce next weekend that the COVID-19 payment will be renewed after the middle of June, when it was otherwise due to lapse, but that it will be paid at a lower rate. Sinead O'Carroll, your thoughts on that. Is the government now going to face accusations of austerity by phasing back a payment that so many people are reliant on?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that they're hoping to rely on is that around 38% of those on the payment, and that's about 220,000 people, are taking home more money on the benefits. So the 350 is more than what they were earning. So there's kind of a couple of things to dissect when you're looking at that, because originally you're thinking, wow, 38% of people on that payment are living on less than, and it's actually less than 300 per week. It's not even the full 350. They're on less than 300 per week, which is quite a sign of the amount of low paid work that is happening in Ireland. But I had a look as well to see how many of those could be part-timers and why those people are working part-time. So you have to go, the CSO has their employment look from Q1 2019, so a year ago, and how many people were working part-time. About 473,000 people working part-time. About 16% of those were working part-time because they could not find a full-time job. So you're talking for that 16% of that 473,000. If they're getting cut back, that doesn't seem as logical as, say, okay, the Supermax workers that Pat McDonagh is quoted in the Sunday Times as saying he can't get some of his part-time workers back because why would they come back to work part-time for 200 quid when they could actually just not work and get 350. So you can see that argument. It's logical to try and cut that money back, to particularly for people who are probably still in full-time education, students, people still in school. But you have to make sure that 16% aren't being discriminated against because they couldn't find full-time work before this, and now they definitely won't be able to find full-time work. It's a headache to try and keep this as fair as possible.
Kevin Doyle, on the question about whether it's as fair as possible, you could also argue that if the state is requiring some businesses to remain shut and not to allow trade at all until August the 10th, that it's going to be a very difficult pill for swallow if the state then also cuts back the welfare that those people are entitled to receive, especially when you're going to have Sinn Féin making the case, as others will, and fairly legitimately, that people should be entitled to the pandemic payment for as long as the state is telling them they can't work.
Yeah, and the Taoiseach has kind of repeatedly hinted at this idea that if people aren't afforded the opportunity to get back to work, then it would be unfair to take them back off or reduce the COVID payment. But that would imply that this is going to go on to August, assuming that we get to the point where pubs will open in August. But even then, you know, venues and you know, events and people who work in that kind of industry, they won't necessarily be back to work. So will they be expected to go back to the job seekers allowance? And I think, yeah, to speak to Sinead's point, like, there are people who were perhaps only working on a Saturday. We all did it when we were in college, you know, the weekend job that got you 80 or 90 quid. And what you spent it on was your own business then, kind of thing. You know, we all did that. And those, I'm aware, people getting 350 euro must seem like a fantastic bonus to be in that situation. So there is an anomaly here that can't be allowed to go on. But to answer your question, I suppose, more directly, Gavin, this is going to become the first big political debate out of the COVID-19 scenario, because it absolutely suits Sinn Féin to argue that the payment should stay as it is and shouldn't be reduced. And who wouldn't agree with them on a micro level? Obviously, the picture around the 30 billion black hole that we're going to have in the economy is different. And then you see people like Willie O'Dea last night, who is tweeting about the exact point, saying that many of these people, the 200,000 that are better off on the COVID payment, were below the poverty line before this, and that he'd oppose any move to drive them back down to a lower income again. Willie O'Dea, a potential social protection minister in a couple of weeks' time, saying statements like that. So you already have divisions within those that will be in the next government.
Are those who certainly we are expecting to be in the next government. We'll talk a little bit more about that in a few minutes' time. But Sinead, one of the points that I'm most struck by in this whole debate around the level of the pandemic payment is that I remember at the start, and maybe it was because the government didn't realise how many people fell into this subset, but Regina Doherty had the case put to her that some people would be better off on this payment than they were working. And it was sort of met with a shrug of the shoulders and just going, well, yep, so be it. I know there's a bit of moral hazard, but sure, it's an emergency. We have to do something. We have to make sure that people have a decent standard of living. Why is it now that Leo Varadkar shows up on News Talk Breakfast earlier in the week and then starts cribbing about the tens of thousands of people who actually fall into that category?
I think because it's costing about 200 million a week, Gavin, and those are adding up. And the reality of this just lasting a hell of a lot longer than we anticipated when those announcements were made from the 12th of March to the 28th of March. And I think more and more officials in the Department of Finance saying this can't continue as is. But I think that this is what Kevin was saying there. It might be one of the big society wrangles, because some people will see it as unfair that those people are earning more money, while others will see it as unfair that they go back down to a position that was entirely unfair in the first place. And that's going to be something that we as a society are going to wrangle with, while also trying to figure out how to remain distant from each other, whether we should be wearing face masks or not, and all the other big questions that this is throwing at us on a daily basis. And we haven't even mentioned since the start that the childcare issue, which is also going to become one of the biggest problems or hurdles to overcome to get the economy back running as it at its best possible before the end of this year.
Yeah, well, one observation on childcare, by the way, I don't think it got reported on much during the week, but the Parliamentary Budgeting Office issued a report about the cost to the state of subsidising childcare wages between the middle of March and the middle of June. It remarked that the state was spending €150 million subsidising that sector, and that is at a time when that sector is providing childcare to pretty much zero children. Just one final point on the pandemic payment though, Kevin, and it goes back to what we were talking about in the first part with Sam McConkie. If you do start to whittle down or unwind the amount that this payment yields for those who are receiving it, it is in itself then going to expedite the arguments or the calls for people to move through the roadmap that bit easier, because they won't want the idea of having to live off less and less at a time when the state is saying they can't go back to work for another 11 weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And these are all the problems that come with that. I mean, it's I think most people want to work, you know, that there is no sense that anybody wants to sit at home on €350 a week, or even €500 a week, or even €1,000 a week. Most people actually want to get up in the morning and go to work. And I think lockdown has probably taught those that did lose their jobs that it's, you know, the actual benefits of going to work are not just the financial income that comes from it. But the whole political debate around this is going to move in all sorts of directions now. And I mean, Sam talked about the need for a strong public debate around exactly how we move through the phases, but not even that, but each element within those phases. And I'm not sure that we're quite at the stage where we're maybe mature enough or relaxed enough, if for want of a better word, to actually have that debate fully, because everybody, and I include myself in this, and you, Gavin, and Sinead, we all have our agendas. We all have things going on in our lives that we would like to be allowed happen. And that kind of a sense of, well, why can't I just do this? Because that's what matters to me right now. And it's very, you cannot please all of the people as we move through these phases. In fact, you can probably please very, very few people. And that's going to be a huge challenge then, because we were all in it together going into lockdown. We are not all in it together when we're coming out.
No, and I can certainly guarantee you that I have an agenda in some of these things, because I see Dominic Cummings going 260 miles up the length of England, and I'd quite like to be going 42 kilometres to go and see my parents and me, than bring my daughter to go and see them, or to bring her to go and see her other grandparents in Kilkenny. And apparently we can't do that. And I'd also love to be leaving her with her childminder just to get a few hours clear work done as well, even though we all love her to bits. On the topic of childcare though, Sinead, there is a lot written about it in today's papers. Particularly, there's a big spread in the Sunday Independent, and Ciara Kelly's writing about how the exit plan kind of highlights the lose-lose system. But there is a bigger question about how the virus is sort of exposing how businesses are so reliant on childcare, and that childcare apparently could be at the forefront of, you know, the battle to actually try and get on top of the virus itself in that kind of biological sense.
Yeah, and I think it will be the one thing that does not go back in any shape or form to what we had before. Probably most likely because, as you mentioned there, the state is going to end up subsidising the sector in a much, much greater way. Mostly because they're going to have to for the next year or two, but we were going that way anyway, and it's just really escalating, expediting a lot of the plans. There's some really interesting stats in Maeve Sheehan's piece in the Sunday Independent today. She has a double page spread, as you mentioned, but she's looking at, in the Republic of Ireland, there's about 50% of families actually still rely on other members of their household for their childcare. So be that grannies or granddads or aunts and uncles, while 34% rely on childminders and only a quarter on creche facilities. So when you're looking at like the absolute chaos that closing creches has caused to workplaces, and that's only still a quarter of families in Ireland, which is quite astounding, I thought. On getting creches back, I think when you heard Sam McConkie talking about what is the priority, I think probably most businesses would argue that that is the priority. And I think most people working from home with children, I'm not one of them, but I know from talking to people and working with people, it is one of the biggest challenges. While parents absolutely love spending more time with their children, doing a full-time work and spending time with your children at home is really not possible.
No, I can speak from personal experience on that one. It sort of feels like you can't devote fully to either. And of course, then you feel very unfulfilled, or you feel very frustrated by the fact that you don't feel like everyone is getting the amount of you that they deserve. Kevin, I suppose the point there that Sinead just made is a really prevalent one, that society has been for so long built on relying on other family members, or particularly grandparents, to try and deal with this. And if that's going to be off the radar, it sort of feels like we'll need to dramatically really redraw the whole idea of how childcare is actually done in this country.
Yeah, completely. And it's one of the most worrying things, I think, of this whole crisis, is that we have managed, the state, the government, if you like, have managed some things really, really well. You know, we were warned about a big surge. They managed to get the hospital capabilities in place to deal with that, if it had come at the level that was being predicted. At one point, they managed to stomp it out in the community. They managed to put a lot of assistance in place, and we often don't hear about a lot of the actual assistance that is going that is happening for people in different communities around the country, because they're happening, and so people get on with life. But childcare has been the one area where it has been an utter failure to solve anything. You know, we were originally told that we would get the frontline workers, that we would get childcare for them. Nothing close to it came, you know, it completely mm-hmm. collapsed. Then we were going to send them into their homes. That didn't happen for insurance reasons. And it really does question how you would now reopen them. Even this idea that's kind of following the Danish and the Nordic model, which we always talk about, and this idea of putting children into pods, and but how you manage it, we just don't have the infrastructure to it. And I really think childcare will be one of the real big problems as we go on out of this. And it's just funny to go to your point, Gavin, that you were making there. I quite liked Paul Sheridan's piece in the Sunday Independent. Just for this one, it's probably, I think, a little description of life in the balancing the work and parenting at home thing, which kind of, I think, will be something a lot of parents can empathise with. But he talks about the 5 minutes of silence, which can mean many things. It can mean they're playing together peacefully, which is rare. It can mean they're plotting against us, which is much more likely. Or it could be that they're doing something dangerous which needs addressing immediately, a twice daily occurrence. And I think that's probably something a lot of parents understand, that 5 minute silence where you get a bit of work done and then you go, oh no, what's happening that they're so quiet? Yeah,
it's the most unnerving solitude anyone will ever get when you get to that phase of your life. Just on the topic of general childcare, of course, childcare is the reason why Dominic Cummings apparently justified driving 260 odd miles from London to Durham. And I accept, obviously, it's a different jurisdiction. They have slightly different rules. But Sinead, it does kind of speak to that whole idea that you really do need to have absolute discipline at the top of the tree in all levels of government, because if anyone is perceived as taking personal liberties, it completely undermines the whole question of asking other people to make sacrifices in their lives too.
Yeah, it creates a real holy show, doesn't it? Like, it's just so simple to say we do as you say, but not as you do. And Dominic Cummings is obviously not the first person caught up in the establishment of in the UK of people who have been caught out doing the wrong thing. We had Neil Ferguson, obviously, the extramarital story, or marital story. I'm not sure how to do that when you're in an open marriage. Yeah. Catherine Calderwood in Scotland.
They didn't have the full weight of number 10 thrown behind them, though, did they?
No, and that is one of the things now that you were mentioning earlier, that, you know, you really want to be able to go the 42 kilometres to your family. So imagine being in the UK now and you have done all the right things. You've had funerals where you've been streamed online. You haven't seen your parents, your kids haven't seen their grandparents, even if they're much shorter. And then you hear Dominic Cummings had symptoms of the coronavirus, or knew that he could likely get sick with it, and he drove 260 miles. That would really, you know, strengthen it, or really test your mettle, whether you could keep going with the stay at home or the stay alert warnings that they have there. And it's just, I think, a real sign of just mishandling on the government's part, not being able to have any ducks in a row. I think there's loads of things you could throw at our government right now that I think mostly the childcare, what Kevin was saying earlier, that there was just very poor decision making around childcare. And I think that was shown as well in that the questions around maternity payments and people coming back on off maternity and how they would fit into the temporary wage subsidy scheme. There didn't seem to be a lot of thinking around parents and those with young families around our table, but across in the UK, there didn't seem to be thinking about anything, really.
There is a big question, isn't there, Kevin Doyle and Sinead O'Carroll, about the formation of government. Kevin, I'll start with you on this. I mean, it's only this time last week we thought the whole row about Fine Gael's secret election planning was being put to bed. Then we had all of that blow up. And just when all of that was put back together again, now suddenly we have the question mark about the Green Party and its leadership.
The Green Party story is just utterly astonishing, to be honest, Gavin. When the initial thing came out and the murmurings around Catherine Martin, and obviously they've been kind of ongoing for a little while, but when she issued that statement and some people tried to interpret it as, oh, okay, she's packaged this away until government formation is complete, so that's fine. It was the total opposite. It was publicly confirming her interest in a heave, for which there seems to be substantial backing. And it is really fascinating now, the internal politics in the Green Party, as one Fianna Fáil said to me, used the famous senior hurling analogy.
That one again. Them, we made it 11:47 for anyone who had it in the book.
Yeah. But it was, to them, it seemed as if the Greens had won the All-Ireland and now wanted to sack the manager before going up to get the cup. And it does feel a little bit like that, because if Catherine Martin is leading the march and simultaneously leading the march up the hill and down the hill at the same time, if you like, it's a kind of a strange one for Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil to manage. And when you read across the papers this morning, I mean, the Mail on Sunday is talking about the idea that they want the Taoiseach role will be the price for power. Very hard to see how Leo Varadkar, if he's to be demoted from Taoiseach, would demote himself all the way to Social Protection Minister or something like that, and hand over the Taoiseach's office. I don't think Fine Gael would take that. And then I think it's the Sunday Business Post talk about them wanting three senior ministers, three junior ministers and three Seanad positions. And then we know that Simon Coveney has been ringing around independents as well. So there's only 15 senior ministries to go around. So it's going to be very hard to please.
And Sinead points out as well that there's talk of them looking for the role of Attorney General. And apparently this is some disquiet on Twitter this morning, because their apparent name being touted for Attorney General is someone who was one of their leading opponents against the repeal referendum a couple of years ago. Sinead, though, it strikes me that Catherine Martin is in a very fortuitous position right now, because she can simultaneously say, as the sort of the figurehead of the anti-Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael wing within the Greens, she can say that if the deal gets voted down, that she never wanted it anyway. But that if the deal does get voted through, she can claim credit for it because she was the chief negotiator who secured it.
Yeah, and Justine McCarthy is writing in the Sunday Times today about how ambitious Catherine Martin is, and also how prestigiously and accurately she has planned her moves over the years, from joining the Green Party to becoming the deputy leader, to getting elected, to getting other Greens elected, to setting up the Women's Caucus. So not headline grabbing career success, Justine writes, but all kind of showing how her style is low key, but she gets the work done that she wants done. So it shouldn't be a surprise that she has put herself forward as a real candidate to rule the party. And the timing may see as you said, fortuitous rather than as a lot of political commentators have kind of looked at it and scratched their head and thought, huh, why are you doing it now? But if you look from personal ambition, maybe it's the right time for her. I would question, though, there is a poll in the Mail on Sunday today looking at people's voting intentions, and Fine Gael are rising high. They're up 15. It's an Ireland Thinks poll. They're up 15, up to 36%. Fianna Fáil are down 6, so that terrible reading for them. But I was looking at some of the data behind that polling, and the Green Party vote is quite soft. So people were asked, would continued difficulties in forming a new government affect your voting preference? And 43% of those Green Party votes said yes, it would. So you would imagine that that Catherine Martin might look at that those kind of numbers and think, okay, we do need to get a deal done. Otherwise, we could be in a very different position if there happens to be another vote.
Yeah, if indeed we were able to actually hold on at all. What's interesting about that, I find, actually, is that even with the financial tumult that the state has been in since the general election, that poll suggests the Green Party would still get 6% of the vote, which is only down one on the general election itself. And given that there's a general sense that the Greens tend to get a lot of votes when people aren't quite as worried about the money in their pockets, it's fascinating they're still holding up that much. Kevin, the one point that I think is worth, though, putting to you is that we can fall into the trap of saying, sure, politicians are always, you know, only looking after for themselves. They always want to, you know, there is no such thing as a non-ambitious politician. Could a case be made that maybe the Green Party is, you know, they do things generally differently, and just because she may have an interest in leading the Green Party doesn't mean that she wants to savage or knife Eamon Ryan in the back while she does it?
But there's no other way of doing it, Gavin, is the problem, is there? Eamon Ryan, who came in after the Greens obviously lost all their seats in the Dáil, and slowly built the party up, albeit with Catherine Martin's help, it has to be said. There is no other way that she becomes leader unless Eamon Ryan gets shafted. And it's not quite the Trevor Sargent scenario where he said he'd never lead them into government with Fianna Fáil, and then he fell back onto a nice job in a junior ministry and handed over to John Gormley. This is something very different. Eamon Ryan has been quite expressive about the idea that he believes the only place for the Green Party to actively make change happen is to be in government. And so if she either takes that option away from him or she knocks him off the perch just as they get into that point, it's still knifing in the back. There's no real way of being polite about it. And I think a lot of people have made the point that Eamon Ryan kind of has been the public face. A lot of people aren't maybe very familiar with Catherine Martin, but she has been the one going around the country meeting all the councillors. She has done the chicken dinner circuit, as they call it, in Fine Gael, and that she has the grassroots on her side.
One thing I think is quite interesting when you compare some of the different prominent female politicians, that we have the big interview in the Sunday Independent today, and Mary Lou McDonald, Sinead, seems to be presuming that she's going to be in that office for at least a decade, even though Sinn Féin actually, by party rule book, have to have a new election every year.
Yeah, it's actually a really fascinating interview. Hugh O'Connell has his question and answers in this Sunday Independent with Mary Lou, and as they kind of get over with at the very start, they talk about, you know, why are you doing this with the Sunday Independent? There's, you know, been obvious tensions between Sinn Féin and the Sunday Independent, and it makes for a really good conversation then. And yeah, at the end she says, look, I am open to challengers, and if there are challengers to that leadership position, but Hugh O'Connell then notes that in Gerry Adams' time, it was always seen as there was never any real challenge, and maybe the party would continue in that vein over the next 10 years. She has also not ruled out any idea that Sinn Féin could be part of the next government. She's saying she'll wait to see what the Green Party decide, and she said there is a decision there. So you would wonder if all things do fall apart with the current talks, and there's a long way to go. Gav, you were on our Explainer podcast during the week because we were marking that 100 days of since the general election, and I was wondering whether there'd be 100 more because when you see all the independent TDs that have, you know, started to speak out a little bit, although usually unnamed in the papers, they all want their say first. So this, whatever programme for government comes back, if there is one that comes back from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party, each of those are going to have their say on something. How long is that going to take?
Yeah, well, you certainly can't just accept them to buy whatever deal is served up to them. They're going to have some input as well. One thing that I find very interesting, just as a final comment in that piece by Hugh O'Connell, which of course is in Kevin Doyle's Sunday Independent today, is that Mary Lou McDonald reveals that Prince Charles has been in touch with her following her recovery from COVID-19. Of course, they had both contracted the virus in the last couple of months. So if you want a measure of how much things have changed, there's one small example, I suppose. You'll find that in the Sunday Independent. We're out of time for now. Kevin Doyle, Group Head of News at INM, and Sinead O'Carroll, editor of the journal.ie. Thank you very much for joining me.